You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where we're ready and we're willing to take it on. There are moments in life that make you step back and appreciate the fact that you're here. Ideally, these moments would be the result of your own hard work and have a direct impact on your quality of life. More often than not, though, they are not. Usually, we are witness to greatness rather than great ourselves. That's not to say that each of us isn't capable of greatness. We are. But it's that witnessing of the achievement of greatness by others that should fuel us to find it in ourselves. Knowing such greatness is possible is the only true source of motivation. Joining me this week via Skype from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards. How are you, Daniel?
Well, I was thoroughly motivated this weekend for perhaps obvious reasons, not the least of which is that I momentarily forgot I lived in the worst city in America.
How did you momentarily forget that?
I was transported as if by a magical touchdown pass to the city of Boston and felt as if I were, let's say, among drunken Irishmen, at least momentarily.
You know, I would have thought it would be the interception that would have done it, not the touchdown pass, but we can get to that in a minute here.
No, I like the touchdown passes.
Also joining us via Skype from the House of Mouse, Elliot Rivera. And I think Elliot was transported somewhere else with one of the touchdown passes.
Oh, let's just say there was some touching. All right. I am in love with Mr. Rob Gronkowski, or Gronk. Move over, Captain America. I have a new man.
So I'm glad you finally moved on from a Patriots fan, Chris Evans, to actually a Patriot. So that's progress.
Moving on up.
He's gorgeous, my God. But yeah, go Patriots. Yes, I was totally rooting for the Patriots. Even before my eyes laid on that gorgeous hunk of meat let's move on.
Let's get motivated. It's the news with Daniel T. Richards.
Of course, what kind of mid-side news segment would this be if we did not lead off with the most important story of the year
thus far,
maybe of ever, and that is, of course, the New England Patriots have won the Super Bowl. In fact, their fourth Super Bowl out of six appearances in the Tom Brady era, eight in total, tied for a record for most appearances by any franchise. Of course, this victory had a lot to do with Tom Brady being, well, fucking Tom Brady. But also it had a lot to do with one Malcolm Butler, whose late interception of Russell Wilson on the 1 yard line by a controversial call, resulted in a turnover that changed the entire feel of life.
Controversial play call, not controversial refs call. I want to be clear about that.
Oh yeah, controversial play call. Yes, no, the refs, for the most part did a fine job. I think one mistake on both sides. So.
I can't even remember though. Think about that for a second. I can't remember a game where I couldn't remember what the refs did. And I can't in this game. So kudos, refs.
Finally you let them play football.
And look what happened.
It was a great game. Yeah. Absolutely. So anyone who wasn't watching, and if you weren't, what were you doing?
You must not be American if you weren't watching.
Yes, exactly. For anyone not watching,
until 10 p.m., just saying.
It was up and down all game, and then going into the fourth quarter, the Patriots were, in fact, down by 10 points. And then Tom Brady worked some magic and overcame the largest fourth quarter deficit in Super Bowl history to be up 28-24, but leaving the Seahawks more than 2 minutes to drive down the field. which they did thanks to several, well, one pretty good pass to Marshawn Lynch, and then one pass that looked like the fucking Keystone Cops, chucked it in the air. What's his name? Curse sort of tips it. Malcolm tips it. He does a cartwheel. The ball hits between his legs, hits him in the groin, bounces off his chest, and then lands in his hands. For anyone who is a Patriots fan or a Super Bowl aficionado, you might recall one David Tyree and his helmet catch in Arizona. And it looked very similar to that, and I think Patriots Nation collectively died inside.
Even Tom Brady said at that point, he said that he never doubted they were going to win the game except when that catch was made, which I think is how many of us felt.
Yes, absolutely. I know that our we didn't have a Super Bowl party. We had a Super Bowl closed gathering. We all went silent. A friend of mine who is a big Patriots fan, Boston fan in general, just went slack-jawed, and I thought he might have had a mini stroke. And I think he kept whispering, "Not again, not again, not again."
That's pretty similar to my reaction. I almost lost it. And I don't mean like I started yelling. I just like almost started crying. Cause I turned around and I looked at everyone in the room and I said, "Are you kidding me? It's the helmet catch again."
Yes. I just texted Justin one word and that word was Tyree.
God, at least we want to cry thinking about it right now.
I know. So, but worry not, anyone who's a Patriots fan, but somehow wasn't listening and is listening to this podcast as a recap of your Super Bowl. The Seahawks made it down to the 1 yard line, and instead of handing the ball to Lynch, they decided to go with a pass play, and therein enter Malcolm Butler, who made an outstanding play, read it perfectly, and made an interception that essentially ended the game. So, I think one of the most overlooked things about this entire end of this game is that it was masterful by both Malcolm Butler and the coaching of one Bill Belichick. What say you?
You is me.
Whoever wants to comment, I assume it's Justin.
It was a good game, and I'm not really into sports, but I mean, it was a nail biter. Like, it was going back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, and I don't know, it was just kind of awesome. Now, this Lynch guy, he's the one that was like, I'm only here so I don't get fined. I'm only here so I don't get fined. That's the same guy, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So this is not that I believe in karma, but this is totally fucking karma, right?
There are actually apparently conspiracy theories, although I've never heard the conspiracy theories. I've only seen a brief ESPN segment commenting on the conspiracy theories. But apparently there are people out there who believed they didn't want Lynch to score the final touchdown because that would have made him Super Bowl MVP. So they had Russell Wilson throw it to make him the Super Bowl MVP because he would answer questions after the game and Marshawn Lynch wouldn't.
That is a stupid theory.
Like I told you, I've never heard it. I've only heard ESPN saying, like, you're saying that it's stupid.
That's how it always is. Rumor, people speculate, even in politics, people speculate that da da da, but then you never actually hear people speculating.
It's true. I don't even know what speculating sounds like. So I don't think that's true. Well, I guess we'll talk about some of the play calling later, but let's be serious. Malcolm Butler, undrafted rookie, gets put in the game because the senior cornerback, was it Arrington?
It was both. It was Arrington and Logan Ryan. I mean, Ryan only played like 6 snaps, but Arrington was in a lot on Chris Matthews, who was playing hardball with his head. I had to make a hardball joke because everybody else did. But yeah, I mean, Arrington was just getting beat a lot because he was like 5'10 or 5'11 or something, and this guy Chris Matthews was tall. So they just kept throwing it high, and he couldn't stop. There was nothing he could do. Even though his coverage was good, there was nothing he could do. So Brandon Browner asked to be put on Matthews. He said, "Let me cover him." And then they switched out Arrington and put in Butler.
Yes. Again, Butler, undrafted rookie, then in the Super Bowl, makes one of the most outstanding reads on a play ever. And intercepts the ball. And one thing I really liked actually about Tom Brady after the game is he said, it's about time he intercepted someone other than me.
Yeah, meaning, apparently he does it in practice all the time. Yeah.
Yes, right. In practice, he plays a lot and he's constantly intercepting Brady in the end zone, which I thought was an awesome comment for Mr. Brady.
You know, it's funny because the, like getting into the sports thing, really and truly, I mean, it's amazing. They really are kind of our heroes. You know what I mean? Like in our culture nowadays, they really are. People regard them within that, in that heroic fashion.
But they are heroes. I mean, isn't what Belichick and Brady did this season heroic? Isn't what Malcolm Butler did heroic? I mean, if you look at Butler's story, which is just starting to come out more, and apparently people aren't really aware of him. I guess I was because I know he's been doing well all season. Like whenever I've seen him play, even in preseason, I knew he was good. But most people are like, who's Malcolm Butler? Even Patriots fans were saying that, which is strange to me. So they've been releasing the story a little bit more, and he was in community college playing and he got thrown out. Then he got his life together, got back in, went to a Division II school, was an undrafted free agent, and then Belichick brought him in, and he's been on the team all season, and now he is, you know, he had the game-winning interception to seal the game for the Patriots. And isn't that journey heroic? Isn't the fact that not only did he work hard and turn his life around and put himself in that position heroic, but isn't it also heroic that Belichick put him in that position?
Yes, I absolutely believe it is. Not to mention the other positive heroic storylines. It has been 10 years since Tom Brady won a Super Bowl. In football time, that is basically multiple lifetimes of NFL players. Seriously, multiple lifetimes of the average NFL player. And he has won now four. One of which, I mean, with this one being 10 years apart. I think that's just insanity.
Yeah, I started
definitely
watching,
underplayed.
I started watching the DVDs last night of the other Super Bowl wins, and honestly, he didn't even look like the same player because he's changed so much and he's evolved so much. You can see the way he's improved and shaped himself since then. So it is, you know, that's the largest gap in between Super Bowl title wins now.
Yeah, the second being 6 years, by the way. In case anyone dare accuse us. I mean, I don't think I'm an NFL apologist in a certain sense. I think there's some things that need to be improved about the NFL, the treatment of players, etc. But this is what really makes it worth it for me, right? This is what gives me the reason to watch, which is to look for these heroic storylines to play out and to be fulfilled by them. And it's one of the areas where I feel like the social justice warriors, while they're trying to have an impact on it, mostly are told to go fuck themselves. Rightly so.
Well,
and perhaps we'll hold on to it for as long as we can, but...
The thing about the NFL is, as long as the sport exists as the sport, there's no way you can get around this. Because there is an objectively agreed upon set of rules. And, you know, maybe the whole game is arbitrary, which is the argument people are going to make. But the point is, everyone can agree those are the rules. And you have to achieve them and succeed in them the best way you can. And as long as that exists, there's always going to be that sort of heroic base to it. We saw how they tried to undermine that this year with the whole Deflategate and cheater thing. And it's been undermined to a lot of people. But their techniques are purely rhetorical. They're purely communication-based. So when you talk about something like a movie, they can easily turn an Iron Man from a hero to a villain, which undermines the heroes and gets rid of heroes. They can easily use naturalism, which says there are no heroes because we're all just responding to things and everything is determined. But you cannot do that in the NFL. You cannot do that when you're watching people do things in reality, achieving a goal that everyone agrees is worthwhile. Because the human efficacy, human free choice and free will is on display. And to me, that is the importance of Tom Brady and Bill Belichick. Because you look at people who use their free will to try and achieve their values, and they do it by being committed and by being intelligent and by being rational. And that is so lacking nowadays.
Yes, and I think particularly with Brady and Belichick, it is in a way that people could really use
as a demonstration in their life. In the same way you might ask, you know, how would a certain fictional character like Howard Roark handle this situation? You could ask the same thing about Belichick or Brady, because not only is it a game to game, literally play to play rational application of their mind, it is also week to week, month to month, over an entire season, and then over multiple seasons, right? How do you keep a strategy that is effective over a quote-unquote dynasty? Now, that's not how they would put it, but I think that's how someone could rationally put it from the outside.
And that's the thing that I think Brady and Belichick have that no other team has. And it's an underlying philosophy of their team and their life. They're not just sticking to rules, and they're not being pragmatic. They're somewhere in between those two. You know, I read an article today in the Wall Street Journal where they said most people lose to the Seahawks because the Seahawks are designed to stop the long passes, which the league so relies on. And a lot of teams won't go away from that because that's their identity or that's what they're built on. So they go, that's how the Seahawks are built to beat someone, to take that away, but we're still going to do it anyway, which is sticking to an arbitrary rule. That's what our team's identity is. That makes no sense. The other side of that is, you know, would be switching every week. And people have tried to say that's the way the Patriots are, that they switch every week. No, they adjust their game plan, but they don't adjust their philosophy of do your job, ignore the noise, speak for yourself, be committed, be educated. They don't change that every week. That's why they're successful, and that's why Belichick and Brady need to be admired and deserve to be admired.
You know who else deserves to be admired is Gronkowski, right, Elliot?
Oh, God, yes. Admire him in a different way, but yes.
You were just being a little quiet there. I had to bring you back into the fold.
No, it's because you guys are making the points much more eloquently than I can. And I'm not, like I said, I have not been a sports guy, so I don't, my view of it is not as emotionally invested as the two of you are. I've kind of lived vicariously through the two of you, through your discussions here. So getting a glimpse of it through actually watching the Super Bowl has been, it was very educational. It was very eye-opening for me to kind of see things that I've always kind of written off as, you know, being the more, for the testosterone-y straight guys, you know, that, and not really understanding what the appeal is, and understanding now through you guys that there's actually, it is about a narrative and it is about heroism, and it's the embodiment very much of what we look for in our art. You know, the idea of romanticism, of people making things happen, not just letting things happen to them. And, not that I'm, that football is, you know, like is comparable necessarily to movies or novels or anything like that, but in a lot of ways you look for the same thing. And it's a very profound insight that I really didn't have before. So you guys have really helped me with that. And actually watching the Super Bowl and seeing people's reactions to it, you know, at the restaurant was very, very helpful to me to really kind of concretize what I've been grasping at little by little by little over these last few months.
It is on the level of art. And I'm going to make a bold claim here, but it is not a coincidence that Zack Snyder is a big football fan, that he is a big Green Bay Packers fan, and that his son is a high school quarterback. It is not a coincidence that he is an epic romanticist and he is a big football fan. It isn't.
Yeah. I don't think it's a coincidence, but I would be reluctant to say that it's on the same level as art. And I don't even mean that in a disparaging way. It is a completely different kind of efficacy for me. So, I wouldn't even want to try to categorize them in any kind of similar manner.
Okay, well, I'm gonna sidestep that debate by saying, all I can say is this. Elliot, you wanna talk about emotional investment? You want to talk about emotional payoff? I've said before how, you know, certain movies and shows like Man of Steel make me cry.
Yeah.
Daniel, how long was it since the game was over that I called you?
It was at least 40 minutes.
I have no idea. I have no conception of time. I honestly don't know right now what time of night the game ended. All I know is when the interception happened, I was in total shock. I had no idea. I was just like, what? And then, you know, they tried to kneel it, or they did the pull off sides, and I was like, that's brilliant. I was still in game mode because Belichick's trained me that until the clock runs out, not to celebrate. Then there was the fight, then everything happened, and then finally it was over, and it was just like this release of 10 years. It was this release of, not 10 years, since 2007. It was this release since 18-1, which Daniel was at, and he can tell you, when that happened, it was like a funeral in my apartment.
It's true.
And them being called cheaters, and seeing them struggle, and seeing them deserve to win, and like, lose because Gronkowski blows out his knee, or Talib gets hurt, and says he can't play, even though it's just because he's a mental wuss. And then, lose because of a helmet catch, or lose because of Wes Welker making a drop, or whatever these reasons we want to say for losing. And then I just lost it. I don't even know how long I cried for, but I don't even know if I've ever cried like that in my life before. Like, I feel like I'm tearing up right now. It was just, it just means so much to me. It means so much to me to see people be able to do this. Because growing up in Massachusetts, you're raised on the idea in the culture that you put in your time with the man, they pay you, and that's the life you're stuck with. That's all you are.
Yeah. I think it was for anyone who seeks true inspiration, anyone who is genuinely interested in greatness and not interested in egalitarianism or bringing down the good. It was an outstanding night for everyone, not just Patriots fans. So,
and it makes me hate the social justice warriors even more, and hate all these people that really want to regulate it out and just want to. It really makes me hate them even more because once you get a taste of that, of what Justin just described, I mean, you realize how completely pernicious and wicked a lot of people's real goals are. I mean, the people who want to tear them down, not just the Patriots, but the entire sport, the idea of sport, the idea of competition, you realize how terrible it is. But and it just chokes you.
I agree, but now all we have to do is say, kiss our four rings of power.
Thank you for that delightful transition into what might be the first genuinely farcical story of the year not related to football. I know we've done a lot of football talk, and rightly so, deservedly so, but welcome back to the farce of reality, ladies and gentlemen. A Texas boy was recently suspended from his Kermit Elementary School. That's right, Kermit.
Kermit the Frog here.
Uh-huh. For bringing the Ring of Power to school. Yes, the Ring of Power from the Lord of the Rings. He brought to school and said that he could turn another little girl invisible, and he was suspended.
What was their rationale for this?
No rationale given, because they, according to the principal, are not allowed to discuss it because of confidentiality issues. But if you look at the past, because this child has been suspended two other times, and you go, aha, this is just the latest in a series of terrible actions by this child. He was suspended earlier this year for referring to a classmate as black, and also for bringing his favorite book to school, the Big Book of Knowledge, which he wanted to impress his teachers with pictures of the solar system, but the teacher found that there was a depiction of a pregnant woman as an illustration, and so he was suspended for bringing lewd photos.
This just sounds like I would never survive in today's school. I mean, this sounds like what I was like. Like, I'm not even kidding.
This kid is 9, by the way. I'm not sure I mentioned that. He's a 4th grader, and so this is just, you want to talk about social justice nonsense, just complete and utter nonsense. He was threatening her with the Ring of Power from the Lord of the Rings. Let's be serious here.
You cannot come up with a better metaphor of them not being able to distinguish reality from fiction, because they've made it so nobody can actually believe in an objective reality.
Right. Not to mention, this kid had 5 days ago seen the final Hobbit movie, so this was sort of on his mind, and it was just part of his imagination and playing around.
Do you really think if a little boy could turn someone invisible, he would be turning a girl invisible and he wouldn't be turning himself invisible and going into the girl's locker room?
At nine? Ambitious child.
They start young nowadays.
Apparently so.
No, but it's just, this is another example of like trying to really get kids, you know, under an authoritarian thumb. Don't question authority. Don't question us. It doesn't matter if I'm wrong. What matters is that I said so and you have to do it the way I tell you. That's what this is another example of.
Yes, my favorite part of this story was actually the father's email to the school where he wrote to the principal, I assure you my son lacks the magical powers necessary to threaten his friend's existence. If he did, I'm sure he'd bring him right back.
That dad's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
I love this dad.
Can we get him on an interview on the podcast? Like, that's the best response ever. I assure you my son lacks the magical powers. That's a Belichick response is what that is.
Yes, we checked the ring. We put it through a series of tests. It in no way is magical. It has never been magical and never will be magical. We are on
Neil deGrasse Tyson will tweet something. Well, the ring is magical, and then we'll have to have Luke text them, tweet again how stupid he is.
There was actually a question like that in the press conference after the Super Bowl where Belichick asked someone and he was just like, we won. Like, what are you asking? it was funny because he finally had his guard down, so he did what his dad was doing, where it's just like, yeah, he's not magical. Like, you think he's magical? Like, can we just start responding to all ridiculous articles like this, like that, like ridiculous like stories? We need to have somebody. Is there an organization that does that and don't say Twitter?
You should start one, Justin. The Bill Belichick Society for Answers to Stupid Questions or something.
We should call it like the official response organization or
something.
Yeah,
something like that.
We issue the official response on all events.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We've looked into it. This 9-year-old boy genuinely has no magical powers.
Only ridiculous stories though. It can't be ones that are like controversial, like, you know, foreign policy and stuff where people disagree and you can have whole debates on it. It just has to be something like this where it's like, the dude has no powers. End of story.
Yeah. Did you see the at midnight recently where the parents were upset because they thought the lights in the back of the school bus were a satanic message?
Yes.
And they wanted the lights changed.
Oh gosh.
That would be another one, yes. And ask me, have you seen the At Midnight recently? The answer to that is yes.
Points! So another one we might actually have an official response to is one of the Super Bowl ads, which I did not see because I was watching the live stream and NBC refused to put on the regular
commercial. This commercial was on the live stream though, because I remember it.
I didn't see it. We watched the whole thing.
Oh, we must have gotten different ads for different locations.
I think so.
Did you keep getting the Mexican avocado ads?
We eventually stopped getting all ads. It just would go to the coverage will resume shortly. And that was it.
Yeah, NBC, you gotta fix your stream game because I was behind. I had to put my phone face down so no one would spoil the Super Bowl for me. And then I had, by the way, people at the party who were on Twitter. And I was like, do not be on Twitter right now. They're like, I'm just going to spoil it for myself, not you. Because the screen kept going black and then freezing and then unfreezing. And, like, I had to look at Pete Carroll for way too long. So.
Is it like looking into the face of Skeletor?
Yes.
Wait, you guys weren't watching it on TV?
No. I don't have cable.
Yeah, I don't have cable either.
You're watching it online. Legally. So apparently there was an uproar on Twitter. Shock. Over an ad at the Super Bowl that T-Mobile put on featuring Sarah Silverman and Chelsea Handler, who were talking about T-Mobile's wireless calling, and they were sort of one-upping each other in terms of where in their mega mansion they could call from.
Which is a way to get everyone to buy your service, is to have two obnoxious celebrities talk about how rich they are.
It's true. In this era of hating everyone that has money, kind of a misstep.
But I don't hate people who have money, and that even pisses me off.
I know. And it was, forget it. So, apparently at one point, I did watch the ad. I don't have to say apparently, it did happen. I promise I did the research. Sarah Silverman says she's calling from a hospital ward. And
it's a delivery
room. Whatever. Same thing. And so she hands the baby that has just been delivered to the mother and says, "I'm sorry, it's a boy." Cut to Twitter. Garrett at G Skillet said, "Sorry, it's a boy." Can you imagine if T-Mobile said the same about a girl? Sexist. At Orthan, what? I'm not even going to give his name out because he can't spell. It's terrible. "Sorry, it's a boy. Is gender bashing garbage that I did not expect from the Uncarrier? Although I'm not surprised Sarah said it." So tweets went on and on like this, basically ad infinitum. The question is, was the ad sexist?
I don't know. I mean, I do agree with what the Garrett guy said, that if it was that said, "Sorry, it's a girl," it would be considered sexist. But here's my thing. I was watching the ad, and it was Sarah Silverman, which is automatically like something stupid is going to be said. And then I was like, who is she talking to? Oh, it's Chelsea Handler. She's probably drunk. So I've already filtered this ad through my "this is stupid bullshit" filter. And then when she said that, I was just kind of like, oh, wow, that joke didn't land at all because it was absolutely retarded. And then I moved on with my life. Like, why is this something I'm going to get outraged about?
It was all over conservative Twitter. Like, the right-wing Twitter sphere was really up in arms about this. I mean, I'm mixed at some of the people who commented on it.
I feel like we don't take the right to task enough. So, here you go. This is bullshit. Stop tweeting about bullshit. There are legitimate things to tweet about. Please focus your attention. Thusly.
Well, I think this is the right wing's obsession with micro issues. And what I mean by that is, yeah, Sarah Silverman is a fucking idiot. Okay? She's not that funny. And, you know, Chelsea Handler is funny sometimes, but it's usually when she's so wasted that she doesn't even realize what she's saying. She's so drunk. But this joke is a result of a deeper cultural problem that social justice warriors and liberals have bored into the culture and made it acceptable. The fact that this kind of a comedian and this kind of a person could be famous enough to be in a Super Bowl commercial is the issue. It's not the joke. The joke is the manifestation of the issue. Focus on the issue, not the joke. The joke is stupid. Look, we just made a reference to At Midnight. I love that show, but you know how often it is that they will just start making stupid liberal jokes where I'm just like, that's not funny. But it's so acceptable in their culture, it's so common in their culture that they think it's okay. For instance, the number of jokes they make about Florida being this backward state, to which I just want to reply to them, you realize you're in California, right? But they need to do that because Florida is the anti-California, so they need to do that to make themselves look better. So there are broader cultural issues that are at stake here. I agree. It shows sexism on Sarah Silverman's part. It shows that she has issues. But I can't worry about that. There are greater issues to focus on.
Hear, hear. Hear, hear.
Thank you for sticking up for Florida, by the way.
It pisses me off every time on At Midnight. They're like, let me pick this person who's a meth guy show how this story means everyone in Florida is a meth head. And I'm like, why don't you go to the Deep South where there's no law and people are cooking meth? Because you're not talking about all the rich retirees in Florida who go down there after they've made their fortunes.
Or just middle class families, you know, the people I work with, the people, I don't know, and it's us and Texas. We're the two that Californian liberals love to shit on. And we're the two that are actually like growing businesses while California's economy is getting down the shitter. So.
It's true.
They can make the jokes.
When my girlfriend and I were leaving California to move to Austin, Texas, this is by the way, a demonstration of the complete and utter ignorance of Californians, primarily Los Angelinos. My girlfriend, who is from Pakistan, so you might guess has slightly darker skin than the average whitey in California, was telling everyone, we're moving to Austin. By the way, Austin, Texas, liberal bastion in this great red state. Anyway, they would ask her, and if it was one person, I would just write it off. But six or seven people asked her if she thought she felt she was going to be safe in Texas. And when she asked, why would I not be safe? They said, oh, well, because you're darker skinned. In Texas! Do you know Texas borders Mexico? Anyone realize that? Okay. End rant.
It's just ridiculous. It's the Southerners are racist. I mean, they don't look at how diverse Southern states are. I mean, it's just ridiculous.
You know what else is ridiculous? All of college.
Yeah.
Including, especially, the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, CUNY or SUNY, who will no longer be using the salutation Mr. or Ms. when addressing students because it is a gendered salutation that could be deemed offensive and certainly not inclusive of those who do not respond to either Mr. or Ms.
Will they use Mrs. if the student is married?
I do not think so. I assume all gendered salutations are out.
And marriage is considered patriarchal and whatever, so they probably won't use that.
It's true. The policy went into effect for the spring 2015 semester and is ongoing to ensure, quote, a respectful, welcoming, and gender-inclusive learning environment.
So, official response, ready? This is our first story where we get to do the official response team response. Ready?
Go for it.
People have genders. They are real. This is stupid for denying the fact that people have genders. The end.
Yay. I like it. I think this could be a segment, by the way.
Yeah.
We could flesh this out. We could have a real go at the official response.
Well, we need a better name than that. So if you, anyone out there, Drew, or other fans out there, would like to name this segment, go ahead and submit it to us. We are open to all suggestions.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Especially Canadian suggestions. You guys are just, you're just smarter up there. I'm sorry, you are. So one other sort of bit of news this week, getting to a very serious topic in a certain sense, came from Jonathan Chait, who is a well-known liberal professor, and he wrote an article in the New York Magazine, the New Yorker, would never publish something like this. Who am I kidding? That it was called Not a Very PC Thing to Say, and he was taking to task the concept of the left adopting political correctness. So Chait's basic argument is that there are two kinds of leftists. There's the old school liberal who believes in individual rights and freedom of expression, and they want to, what is he called, democratize the political process to make sure everyone has a voice and they can use, it's sort of if you're familiar, the vision of the old left from Ayn Rand. We can use science and reason and industrial nature to create a more egalitarian society, right? And he's contrasting this with modern day liberals who believe more in the, if you say something that offends me, you must be shut up immediately because we don't have to tolerate your intolerance. And he provides a number of examples, many of which were fairly frightening to me. Apparently, a Muslim student at the University of Michigan wrote in the conservative paper a satirical column denouncing a white, cisgendered, hetero, upper-class man who offered to help him up when he slipped, leading him to denounce, quote, our barbaric attitude toward people of left-handedness. Chait writes, this is a gentle tone of mockery much closer to Charlie Brown than Charlie Hebdo. But the next day, this Muslim student found the doorway of his dorm copied or with flyers all over them, with messages like, you scum, embarrass us, shut the fuck up, do you even go here, leave, and they posted a picture of a demon and splattered eggs on his door. So, has political correctness finally gone too far?
Finally, as if it hadn't gone too far before? I mean, I think we...
Loaded question.
I think we jumped that shark a while ago.
Yes, I think so. There are many other examples in here, including a professor who physically attacked an anti-abortion protester who was ironically standing in a free speech zone. And then the other professors and students actually backed the professor who did the attacking, saying that the girl's signs were a quote-unquote trigger and a microaggression toward people who are pro-choice.
That's the new thing, right? Microaggression. You know, I said before that one of the things we're going to have to get used to is transgender is the new issue they're going to go after, and they're going to make into the common culture in the national mentality. That's not the word I'm looking for. The national.
Zeitgeist?
Yeah, the zeitgeist is a good one. Zeitgeist is a good one. But the other thing they're going to try and add into the national zeitgeist is microaggressions.
Yes. Basically, the concept being that there are certain words or phrases that have sociological power tied to them. And when you say them, just the act of saying these words commits an aggression toward the person hearing the word, where they are now literally equating ideas with violence.
Right, because what is going on here is this is making the other person's reaction more important to what you're saying. Because it's saying what matters when you communicate is not what you're saying, it's how they respond to it.
And how is this different than the Dark Ages with people accusing others of witchcraft and magic? I mean, the idea of using words that these words might actually cause some kind of a change or an issue, you know, it's no different than people accusing other people of casting spells, you know?
Well, I think there is a difference, and I think we need to parse this out. Look, when certain people say certain things to you, they upset you or they make you happy, right? So, for instance, if you say to me, Deflategate, that upsets me, mm-hmm. okay? If you say the Patriots are cheaters, that upsets me. But if you go to me, Tom Brady is the greatest quarterback of all time, that makes me happy. Bill Belichick is the greatest coach of all time, that makes me happy. Those are my responses to it. And I have those responses. But those are not microaggressions when they call the Patriots cheaters, because my reaction isn't what's privileged, it's them expressing themselves. Because they have a right to express themselves. Now, should they do it responsibly and maturely? Yes. But we can't start legislating and we can't start socially shaming based upon somebody not doing it rationally or maturely. Because we have to respect their right to express themselves. Otherwise, no one can talk. Because yes, we all have reactions to things and we all have different reactions to things. And the only way that can be expressed, what the different reactions are, and to have a conversation, is if we privilege the conversation starting, not the reaction to the conversation. So they're paradoxically destroying their own argument.
It is the social justice people eating themselves in a certain sense.
Right. And I didn't mean to shout you down, Elliot. I wasn't going like social justice warrior on you. I think it's important to say, I do understand what they're saying. When certain words people say hurt me, I can have that. I can say I can have that experience, but I'm able to look at myself and say, I know why that is. Or if I don't know why that is, I step back and I go, I got to figure that out. Cause I don't want some random person to come up to me and go turquoise blue. And I get upset.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm just saying I'm talking about people who think the opposite of that. Who think that words detached of any meaning or detached of, I mean, like the story we did about the little boy, he referred to somebody as black and he got suspended for it. I mean, it's that kind of thing. Like the use of the word black is treated like a hex. That's why I brought up that kind of parallel.
I think the issue is there are people who are black, and they hear the word black, and it's been used in an offensive way towards them in the past, so they have issues with it, and when they hear it, they don't want anyone else to say it anymore because it upsets them. And rather than sort it out themselves, they put the onus on other people.
Yeah. So Chait, by the way, reminding you that he is a dedicated liberal. He is no friend of conservatism or of any right-wing ideology. But I think this paragraph really stands out to me. And by the way, this went mega viral in the political sphere this week. So that's why we're covering it. He says, quote, "Liberals believe or ought to believe that social progress can continue while we maintain our traditional ideal of a free political marketplace where we can reason together as individuals. Political correctness challenges that bedrock liberal idea. While politically less threatening than conservatism, the PC left is actually more philosophically threatening. It is an undemocratic creed."
I thought that was an interesting distinction that he made between the philosophical, who he sees as a political enemy, and what he sees as a philosophical enemy. Mm. Very, very observant on his part. Not something you see in commentary often.
Yeah, there needs to be more of that. And that goes back to what I was saying about in the previous article, I believe, where I was saying conservatives. No, I was talking about with the Super Bowl ad. Conservatives always see things on the practical political level. They don't ever see it as a philosophical battle, and that's the problem. They think if they get another person elected, it's going to fix it. They think if they pass a law, it's going to fix it. And the issue is it's not, because there are these deeper philosophical issues.
Yeah, I think the left in general has been more astute about the idea that philosophy matters in a certain sense. And I think that's actually why the political correctness movement has made such huge strides in a relatively short period of time, because they're attacking the ideology first. They're saying that ideas matter. Ideas matter so much that they are literally swords. And that's very appealing to young people, especially, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you mean young people who haven't developed the coping mechanisms yet to figure out how to deal with their emotions and the way people treat them and talk to them.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you might expect, Jonathan was called everything in the comments from a Nazi and a right-wing apologist, a fascist. People said he should be killed, literally said he should be killed. So, you know, just proving the point. Don't you hate when that happens?
All right, let's diffuse this a little bit. Let's take this down. The year is young, but there's already been some great new shows we need to talk about. We do that next in TV with JML. So before we discuss some very, very good shows that are new or I've discovered recently, I want to speak to my experience with a show that is not so good in my opinion. Every once in a while, when I'm looking for something to watch quick, I'll pull up Hulu and I'll see what's up there, and the premiere of Backstrom was on. And Backstrom has been heavily marketed. It's the show with Rainn Wilson as sort of this surly, I want to think misogynistic, but that's not the word I'm looking for. Misanthropic, but he is also misogynistic. Cop.
Is it like House meets S.H.I.E.L.D.?
Well, and that is basically the issue of it, is it's basically just a really poor House knockoff. And I guess it's been getting hype. I guess there have been good reviews of it, but I really don't understand it. The writing wasn't good. The acting wasn't good. Rainn Wilson just looks like he's going through the motions. I think maybe he signed on to it and then realized what happened when he was in the middle of it and was like, well, I guess I committed to this. And then, really funny side thing though, is there was one guy in it who looked really familiar. And he's not famous at all. So I was like, who is this guy? So I looked him up on IMDb and he's the guy who played John Galt in Part 3. Of Atlas Shrugged, and he's also the guy who shoots off philosophical mumbo jumbo nonsense. So you can see why he got the role.
Interesting. It's so Rain did a promo on At Midnight. I'm sure you saw it.
Right, that's part of the
aggressive marketing.
He did
not look enthusiastic at all about it. I actually commented at the moment to my girlfriend that he looks like he is. It was forced to be here by some silly contractual agreement. He was not happy to be promoting that show.
Yeah, and you can tell in his performance.
Yeah.
So
I've sort of hovered over it in Hulu like 10 or 11 times now. And then every time I'm like, okay, South Park.
Yeah. I mean, it's just Fox will not move on from the whole House Jack Bauer thing. They just keep trying to bring it back. Everything is just another version of that. But let's move on to something much more exciting. We'll give the floor to Elliot here because it involves singing, and it's on ABC, and Disney's the parent company for that. Created by the man who did the sitcom The Neighbors, which I thought was very, very funny. There is a half-hour sitcom that has just finished airing its first season of 8 episodes. It's a musical sitcom about a knight in medieval times called Gallivant.
Yes! Yes!
I didn't know it was a musical. That's hysterical.
It was a musical. I was so excited. Oh, I love Okay, let me give you my impression. All right, so the story of Gallivant, and it's not really a spoiler because you find out like within the first 5 minutes of the pilot. The story, it starts off at the end of a traditional story. The hero shows up to rescue the maiden that has been kidnapped by the king and being forced to wed the king. And as he shows up and declares his love in a room packed with people, the maiden turns to him and says, "Actually, I'd rather keep the fame and fortune and marry the king. So, sorry." Which just demoralizes our hero. And so, it just breaks his heart. So a year later, he is called upon by the daughter of the king of Valencia, a princess, to please save the kingdom of Valencia from the wicked king. The king, by the way, is brilliantly portrayed by Timothy Olmedson, whom if you watch Psych, you'll remember as Detective Carlton Lassiter. He is just brilliant as the king. I love him. He's probably my favorite performance in the whole thing. And the story is just, it's so fun. There's so much music, so much laughter. I mean, it's like...
You might say it's gay.
It's gay, yes, it's gay in the proper sense. It's gay and lighthearted and happy and fun. It's like Men in Tights meets The Princess Bride meets Once Upon a Time meets Spamalot or Monty Python. You know, it's all of that in one.
And it's fantastic. Multiple Mel Brooks things in one.
Okay. I know, it was fantastic. I thought it was so funny.
Interesting. Yeah. I've actually have this one, I'm not sure if it's officially queued up, but I have it in my mental queue to watch. Had no idea it was a musical.
Yeah, that surprised me as well when I started watching it. And the thing that makes it actually extra cool as a musical is the guy who does the music was the composer for Aladdin, and one of the producers/writers on the show is Scott Wiener, who voiced Aladdin. So there's a bit of an Aladdin undercurrent to it.
But, okay, so is it all original music?
Yes.
So it's not like medieval Glee.
Oh, well,
no, it's not.
Sort of is. Oh, you mean it's not the it's not pop songs?
Yeah, yeah, they don't take like modern songs and set them in, you know, Camelot or wherever the hell they are.
No, but it's always going to have the Glee comparison because they just break out into song.
Well, that's just a musical. I understand that. That's just a musical.
It's not a jukebox musical. They didn't write a story around existing songs like Singing in the Rain or anything like that.
Right, okay. Like one episode they have Weird Al as a singing monk, so they sing about being singing monks.
Yes. Okay, I'm sold!
And John Stamos as a knight in a jousting competition.
Yes, oh, and this is the greatest casting of all. It took me like 2 episodes to figure it out, because he doesn't have glasses on or anything and he's not nerdy, but Magnitude from Community is in this show as the squire.
Yes.
Pop, pop.
Yes, and you wouldn't even know it was him.
Luke Young is his name.
Interesting. All right, I'll give it a chance. I like it. Sounds good.
All right, now time to sell you all on another show.
No more.
This next show, I actually like even more than Gallivant. So I think Gallivant is decent. I think it's creative. They're trying to do something different with television. I think it's great. Let people try and do that. We need to support that. But this next show, if you want to talk about romantic, and you want to talk about using that to talk about your content and your theme the best way possible, this show is the ultimate of that. So FXX just released the show Man Seeking Woman. Have either of you heard of this show?
No.
I have not even heard of it.
Well, it stars Jay Baruchel. Have you heard of him?
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. Love him. She's Out of My League.
And there's actually something you'll appreciate. I thought about you during one of the lines because he actually basically says in the show, "I could never get a girl like that." And I was like, you've already been through that storyline. But it's a very similar storyline to that. So the whole show starts with him breaking up with his girlfriend of a very long time. And then it goes into all his dating woes. But here's the twist of this show. everything in it is pretty normal, but they always exaggerate one thing. So, in the first episode, there's been three so far, in the first episode, what they exaggerate is, he gets set up on a date. Except he gets set up on a date with a troll. So what they're exaggerating is when you're on a blind date and they set you up with someone really gross, right? So their personality is gross and the way they look is gross. But then they take that situation and the way they do it is hilarious. So he talks about his friend, who's the other character of the show. He's the counterpoint to him, he's the ladies' man. He can basically sleep with anyone he wants and all he wants to do is sleep with people. And, you know, they show him early in the episode on Tinder. So, again, we see this is romantic, you know, they're contrasting things around their theme. So he's explaining that to his date, how, you know, his buddy always dates around a lot. And then he says, yeah, he's always trolling on the internet for girls. To which this troll flips out on him, starts biting him, starts grabbing him. He tries to get rid of her, and she just, like, keeps running into him like a linebacker. And then what do you think everyone's reaction in the bar is?
He's being a jerk?
Yes. Even though he's got, like, his leg is bleeding profusely. And they were like, you need to apologize to her.
I like it.
Then,
sold!
Then, oh, it gets even better. Later in the episode, he goes to a party at his ex's house, apartment, to see her. Because he's still in love with her, but she just invites him over because she's having a party with her new boyfriend. Her new boyfriend is... Adolf Hitler.
Oh.
Are you serious?
Yes. And everyone's okay with him and thinks he's awesome. And he's like, she's literally dating Hitler. And this is, of course, making fun of the idea and, you know, going over the top with the idea that we always hate whoever the person's next relationship is with.
Yeah. All right. I'm sold on that, too. I hate you, by the way. Because I already have no time in my life for anything, including
breathing.
But
this show is that good. It needs... I don't know if I'm allowed to say this because of our brand, but it needs to be watched, all right?
You can say that. That's fair.
It's honestly, if it keeps going at this high quality, it's one of my favorite shows ever. The first three episodes have been brilliant. It's called Man Seeking Woman. They take all the things that it's like being a guy in today's age, and they exaggerate it and make fun of it.
I hope they continue to do that. Jay also is the voice of Hiccup from How to Train Your Dragon.
Yes.
So, excellent.
All right, one last show. So, do you think we need a British Twilight Zone update for the internet age?
Sounds millennially terrible.
You would think that, but the show Black Mirror, which has been around for a few years apparently, I discovered on Twitter while promoting the web series that I'm working on, somebody had a list of all the shows they liked, and because I'm on The Walking Dead, that's a different show, because I'm on The Walking Dead hashtag, their list of shows that they really like was on there, and the list, this is literally their list, right? It was
Walking Dead,
Lost, Hannibal, Walking Dead, and then there was a fourth show I really like, and then this show, Black Mirror. So I was like, you've named shows I very much love. So then I downloaded the first episode.
Are you stalking me?
Yeah, I was like, who are you? I need to introduce you to the concept of romanticism. And that's what this show is. It's very, I mean, we talked about, you know, in my article, Real or Ideal, The Choice of Steel, talks about how The Twilight Zone is very romantic. And they were able to do it because they were doing it in these hypotheticals. Well, this is the same way. The first episode is about how the Princess of England is captured, and the captor releases the video on YouTube, his demand video on YouTube, and his demand video looks very much like a terrorist decapitation video where it's just her and the guy's off camera and he's making her say all the things. Except this is where the satire comes in and makes it ridiculous. The demands are the Prime Minister has to fuck a pig by 4 p.m. or he'll kill the princess. Now, it sounds really bad, right? It sounds ridiculous, but it was so well done. I was literally emotionally moved by the way they showed how all the characters were affected by this.
The way he just wailed away on that pig just brought a tear to your eye.
That's a spoiler. I'm not going to say whether he actually fucks the pig or not.
Making it squeal.
But they showed how the way the communication technology in the world has evolved made this happen. And it's very well done. And then I've watched the other two episodes in season one because, of course, it's a British show, so they have like three episodes and call it a season because it's publicly funded. But and the other two episodes were much more science fiction in the fact that they focused more on technology. This one, you know, it was mainly only focusing on social media. The other two episodes focused very much on technology and how they, you know, did exaggerated worlds about that. But they were very well done, and the commentary was very, very good. I think it was very in line with what we believe here in the Midside.
Hmm. Interesting. Might check it out. Seems a little, like, that terrorist is a little postmodern for me.
Well,
like, once terrorists get to that level.
But this is what I will say to you, and this is what's going to, you're going to hate me because you're going to want to watch it now. That's ultimately the point they're making and making fun of and critiquing.
They're critiquing postmodernism.
Yes.
Sold!
And no, I know I've convinced all of you to watch a lot of TV this week, but I think it's important to note that we've been kind of in a dry spell of late. I mean, The Walking Dead's been disappointing us. I mean, Doctor Who was decent, but it wasn't as good as it's usually been. There's not a lot on right now to be that excited about.
It's
but
true.
These shows, Agent Man Carter, Seeking
Agent
Woman.
Carter's disappointing too, if I may say that.
What?
Agent Carter's been disappointing a little bit too.
I watched the first episode and was like, I don't want anything to do with this. Like I said, I'm over Marvel.
Drop the mic.
We will.
I actually have two quick shows.
Okay.
To talk about very quickly though, because I'm not sure either are. Well, here we go. So, Faiz and I watched the first season of The 100. Not a new show, but it's in its second season playing now.
It's on CW, right?
Yes. Can't see the first five episodes because they're already past. Most annoying thing in the entire world.
Yeah, I started watching Constantine on Hulu Plus on your account, and I watched the first episode.
Oh.
I watched the first episode, and it was decent. And then I like took a break for like 2 months and then I was like, oh, you know, I would like to watch the rest of Constantine. That was decent and Goyer wrote it, so it has potential. And then it's on like episode 8, so I can't watch it.
Yes, it's completely unavailable. But here's my entire review of The 100, which is that it's Lost meets The Hunger Games with an amphetamine addiction. So basically, there are like 1,000 weird, crazy cliffhanger plot twist per episode. And it's just nonstop sort of, oh my god, this insane thing happened. But who are these crazy people? Oh my god, there's a new weapon. Did you realize they had guns? Holy shit, it's raining. And a lot of walking back and forth.
So it's worth watching or not? Again, because there's a certain entertainment value to that.
So I will say this much, which is, after about the first episode, I turned to Faiza and said, this is the stupidest fucking thing I've ever seen. I'm not watching one more minute of this. And then suddenly the season was over. I was like, wait, where's the second season? I gotta know what happened. Cause it's that fucking Lost effect where every single thing ends in the most dire possible cliffhanger you can imagine. And you just go, I have to know what happens in the next scene.
Right, because they get the fact that you're a completist, so they know you want to know what happens.
Yes. So there's that. There are some redeeming qualities, but it's very teenage sort of drama. So if you're into that kind of thing, it will be particularly rewarding, and if you're not,
right,
it'll be particularly painful.
Right.
And then one other one, which I am just loving the hell out of because of my love for political dramas, especially dark political dramas, is the Stars series, Boss.
Oh, about with Kelsey Grammer.
Kelsey Grammer plays the insanely corrupt mayor of Chicago. another reason this appeals to me, and his insanely corrupt administration, how they maintain power through a lot of fear and intimidation. And it has a very, you might call it a used up plot device, which you learn in the first 10 seconds, so it's not a spoiler, which is that Kelsey Grammer, playing the mayor, has an incurable disease that is going to make him lose his mental and physical capacities in a very short period of time.
And so then does he start to cook meth and suddenly he's healed?
No meth cooking. No meth cooking. Cooking books. Lots of cooking books. But he then, so he's trying to sort of force his entire legacy into the final, you know, X number of years of his life and how he deals with it. It's very House of Cards-esque.
So I was just going to say, would you describe this as House of Cards meets Breaking Bad?
It's not bad. It's not bad, actually. I think you might, this might be bizarre to say, especially to Justin, who has seen, I think, a little bit of House of Cards. It's slightly less romantic than House of Cards. It's pretty naturalistic, not in a sort of grotesque bodily way, like
Orange is the New Black. Yeah.
Right. But in a very sort of, the events are very naturalistic. It's not a lot of high drama in that regard, because it's on a city level, not on a nationwide level. So you can't have huge crises coming up that the mayor of Chicago can handle, right? It's more like ward boss and alderman tension.
Right, sort of like the killing where they had that local girl killed where it would have been national news, but they had to keep finding reasons to make it smaller and smaller.
Yeah, exactly. So, but that's, for someone who loves political dramatization, I'm just salivating constantly about that kind of thing. So in that sense, it's good. And Kelsey Grammer is unbelievable. He plays a tremendous douchey bad guy. Who would have thought?
Yeah, that was the one reason I've considered watching this show, but you just put it too close to naturalism for me to want to have anything to do with.
Just watch one episode. Just watch the first episode to see his performance, and you'll get sort of the entirety of what it's about. He's a tremendous performer. And he won a Golden Globe for it.
Right, which was another reason I considered watching it. So, yeah. But naturalism just, it takes away all my motivation in life, so I really don't want anything to do with it. And if there's another thing in life that'll attack your motivation, it's the internet. Let's see what it has to say in Reddit on Reddit. Our jailbait no longer fits like that if a firefly spending too much time online. Batman's face should be shot. Can we legalize pot? TAE feel like this. Better drink my own piss. Sony stupid, Xbox lame, PC gaming all the way. EA blows, Steam rocks, got risk for my firefox. These things are all on Reddit. Mostly pics of felines, comma boring felines. These things are all on Reddit. No, we didn't post it, but we will repost it. First Reddit. See what I did there?
Yes, genius.
It just says, the Seattle Seahawks play calling. And it's under r/jokes. So of course, what's being referred to here is the fact that everyone thinks the decision to throw the ball that was intercepted is the worst play call in the history of play calls because Marshawn Lynch is on the Seahawks and they had the ball on the one. So everyone thinks they should have just run the football. And because everyone thinks that, and they're saying even Joe Schmo on the couch thinks that, the National Football League head coach should have known that as well. Because apparently everyone is now smarter than an NFL head coach who's won a Super Bowl.
It's true.
So that's what the basic point of this thread is.
It's true.
Now, there's a broader issue here, which even Elliot has noticed, so we're actually going to let Elliot handle that football commentary in a second. But I want to make the actual football strategy comment first, just to put this to bed. This is not the worst play call in the history of play calls. This is Pete Carroll being Pete Carroll, all right? He has the logic behind what he did, and he was well-meaning. Maybe it was wrong, maybe it was right. But Pete Carroll thought it through. This is what his thought process was. With 40 seconds left, his team ran the ball down to the one. The clock was ticking. They had one timeout. It was second and goal, so they had three plays left. He was playing, assuming they would score also wanting to run out the clock. So knowing that, with only one timeout, you can't run the ball three times. You don't have time to line up and do that. So you're going to have to throw it once, run twice, and call timeout between the two run plays. That's assuming it takes all three to score. So what he figured was, I'm going to catch them off guard because they're in their goal line personnel, and I'm just going to throw it and score. Now, I think his faulty assumption was assuming you're going to score. Never assume you're going to score. Always try your hardest to score first and worry about the clock, game clock later. That discussion actually came up when the Patriots were driving with 2 minutes left, and people said, or the announcers were asking, do they score or are they scoring too quickly, leaving time on the clock? To which the other announcer correctly said, you worry about scoring. You don't worry about how much time is left at this point. I think that's the mistake the Seahawks made. They were looking at it as a holistic thing, saying, what am I going to do for all three plays? When you got 3 plays left to win the Super Bowl for the year, just do whatever the best plays are. But the point is, it's not the worst play call ever. It's the execution that was the issue. If you look at where the ball was thrown, it was actually a little ahead of him when the defender was ahead of him, and the ball actually wasn't even intercepted in the end zone. So it wasn't like he threw it into the end zone for the guy to get there.
Yeah, so a couple things on this. One is that, just talking about the actual execution of the play itself, it was a little sort of poorly executed, not terribly executed, and I think it was the New York Times, of all places, that sort of showed like multiple camera angles in the play, and basically until the moment of the interception, the play looks like a touchdown. It looks like an easy touchdown from every single angle. So there are a couple things about this. Like, one, do people think the Patriots weren't on the field when this play was called? Like, okay, so it was a quote-unquote bad play call. But it doesn't mean he called, throw the ball to the Patriots. Throw the ball to the Patriots. The Patriots, Malcolm Butler, had to make a tremendous read and a tremendous athletic feat to intercept that ball. Number one. Number two, there was a bunch of stats being thrown around, like 57% of all goal line runs result in a touchdown, and the Patriots were like apparently the worst in the league this year against that, which I wasn't entirely sure that was true, but that was what was being thrown around. But if you look at it, if you go back and actually look at Seattle, Marshawn Lynch was only 2 for 7 on goal line runs this year. 2 for 7! Not very good. So why would you run it on the first play there? That makes no sense to me. So, hate defending the Seahawks, because, well, they're the Seahawks, but have to in this scenario. Thanks, world.
But I think we have to defend the Seahawks in this scenario because of the broader point. Right, Elliot?
I agree. I mean, I think that the point that I was making like before the show, and it's kind of unrelated to this specifically, because I don't
fully... It's not unrelated at all.
It's just I don't fully understand, you know, a lot of the games, the rules and stuff, but it just seems to me that a lot of the focus in the media, on Twitter, and even, you know, at work today, you know, with some of my coworkers, the focus is not on the Patriots winning. It's on the fact that the Seahawks lost. And that's very odd to me, because what we're being inured to the idea that the Patriots have not actually won. You know, as if the Seahawks lost and the Patriots won by default, not by anything that they did, not by how they played, but simply by chance or by luck, which completely undermines what we've discussed on this podcast, not just in this episode, but previously, where we talk about motivation, we talk about discipline, we talk about working to be better every time. You know, every time that there's a game, Tom Brady does, you know, he has his routine, he has his discipline, he works to be better. And that just, the idea that the Patriots won by accident just flies in the face of all of that preparation. And it's really disconcerting to see this kind of language being picked up all across social media. It's very disconcerting.
And you've said how it's connected. Exactly with what you just said. It's about undermining the Patriots' win. And it's happening for two reasons. The first reason is the storyline leading up to the game. This game was never supposed to be about the Patriots to the media. There has been a major disconnect between the media and the common American public here. The media wanted this to be about the unstoppable juggernaut Seahawks. And when they saw that catch by Curse, and the new Patriots Nation thought, oh crap, it's going to happen again. Not because we necessarily thought we were going to lose. Believe me, we've seen plenty of goal line stands from the defense throughout the years. But just, you know, it's one of those psychological damage PTSD things, right? You see an unbelievable catch, you go, no way, not again. They saw that, and they latched onto it because that was their storyline already. That catch gave them the excuse to say, oh, it doesn't matter that Brady threw four touchdown passes and led the largest comeback in the fourth quarter ever in Super Bowl history, down by 10 points. It doesn't matter that they put up 28 points on the vaunted Seahawks defense. And by the way, I'd like to note at halftime, I called Daniel and said, we put up 14. If we can put up 14 more in the second half, we'll win the game. There's no way they can match that. Yeah. Looks like I was right. And then that's the first thing, right? That was their storyline. And the second thing is, this is a storyline post-game. This is already setting up the argument for why Tom Brady is not the best ever. Because what's going to happen in 6 months, a year from now, when people start saying Brady's the best ever? Because people are already saying it, and right now, no one's arguing against it. Mm. They're basically saying, we can't really say anything. He is the best ever, because that's what they were afraid was going to happen, right? That's why Deflategate happened. They were looking for a way to put an asterisk next to Brady and undermine him. This is their way to undermine him in the long run and say, he didn't really win that fourth Super Bowl. He was given it by the Seahawks and given it by Pete Carroll. That's why they're saying it.
It is not only that. It is even worse than that. If you listen to some of the commentary today, the storyline today, other than the Patriots won, because that's obviously you have to go with that as your big story. Otherwise you're an illegitimate sports media outlet. But the subsequent stories were looking at the past Patriot wins. Why are they all so close? Why aren't the Patriots blowing people out? And basically the storyline that was evolving was the Patriots could just as easily be 0-6 in the Super Bowl. This is what's going to come out in the next.
6-0.
I know, it cuts both ways, but the point is they get to undercut a legendary player by saying, he didn't blow people out in the Super Bowl, therefore it could have been 0-6.
So you're saying
this
that
is what's
actually,
coming. This yeah. is what's coming.
You're just taking the argument and multiplying it.
Yes. Indeed.
Right. So my heart does go out to the Seahawks fans. That is a really awful, heartbreaking way to lose. I mean, after seeing David Tyree in the 18-1 game, I will always say no loss any other team can ever suffer or my team can suffer will be that bad. And I truly believe that. But this is pretty heartbreaking up there to lose the best Super Bowl ever based on that.
Wasn't the NFC just like the most heartbreaking sequence of games this season? The Lions have a heartbreaking loss to the Cowboys. The Cowboys have a heartbreaking loss to Packers? Yeah, and then the Packers have a heartbreaking loss to Seattle, and here we are.
So it's appropriate then. It was the transferist of heartbreak.
I think so. The heartbreak just went down through the NFC generations there. Yeah, but no, I just thought it was... To me, if there was such a thing as karma or retribution, which I don't believe there is, but just to be stupid for a second... Then the curse catch with the bobble knees nonsense was immediately negated in karma by the interception, because everyone's talking about how the Seahawks threw that away at the end there, literally, but they wouldn't have even been anywhere near the opportunity to do that if not for the magical bouncy ball in his lap.
Right, but that's the thing that makes you wonder sometimes. At least it makes me wonder sometimes. Not only did that satisfy the plot line of the transference of heartbreak, but it also satisfied this whole retribution storyline for the Patriots. Like, if somebody told me before the game that your team that over the past, you know, 8 years has had shit talked about them and basically everything they've done has been undermined because, quote unquote, they've never won a Super Bowl since Spygate, are going to be winning the game, and in 40 seconds left, they're going to be a ridiculous catch that parallels Tyree, yet they're going to win. I was going to say, you made that shit up. I would say, you made that shit up. There's no way that could ever happen. But that happened in reality. It's like somebody wrote it.
I think it's law of large numbers.
I mean, it is law of large numbers. Law of large numbers. But just,
easy for you to say.
But think about the way it ended up like that. It's insane. Yeah.
This is what it takes for Justin to, like, posit the idea of a god.
It is. No, it is. It is. Look at it. Look at it.
Get down there and look at it. We're rubbing our noses at it.
This is what I'm saying. Robert Kraft sat there, and Daniel, I don't know about how you felt when he said that, but this is, again, when I was in tears. But he said exactly why I was in tears. And he said, I never thought a Super Bowl would mean as much as the 2001 win. Which I thought too. Cause that literally, it changed my life. I know people get pissed when I say that, but it did. Seeing that changed my life. And now I'm here and I have Brady and Belichick as heroes, and seeing the way they live their life changed my life. So 2001 changed my life. And then Kraft said, after winning this one, I never thought another Super Bowl could feel the way that felt and could mean as much as that one felt. But everyone in Patriots Nation knows right now, any true Patriot fan knows right now how it feels and knows that it does feel like that. And I don't know how you felt, Daniel, during that, but I was like, that's exactly why I'm crying right now. And I don't know if anyone else understands it, but I get it. And then I knew, I said, he's speaking right to me.
Yeah. Yep. I think it was epic, but, to sort of redirect back to the question, you know, play calling is a factor, but you have to concede that everything else is a factor. It's a complete game. There is an offense and a defense, and you're not playing in a vacuum.
And you gave up 14 points to Tom Brady in the fourth quarter. Maybe your defense should have stepped up, huh?
Yeah. Exactly.
All right. Moving on to something else. Second Reddit about the Super Bowl. I know everyone here probably hates Katy Perry. Ding, ding, ding. But that halftime show was fucking awesome. And my response to this is, what? Exactly.
Were you watching the same halftime show?
I
watched
it, so I can't, because I can't stand Katy Perry. All I'm going to say, and I know that this isn't up here on Reddit, but I'm just happy Idina Menzel, you know, she sang the national anthem, and yeah, she traveled through a couple of different keys, but she didn't completely botch it. So I'm very, very pleased with that. Katy Perry, I don't give two shits about.
Katy Perry was riding a firework.
Is that a euphemism?
I wish it was. I don't get it. I don't think she's talented. The only moment of the halftime show where I got genuinely excited was they focused in on this dark silhouetted figure who was about to come out, and I literally screamed, because I was sitting across the room at this point, not near the TV, was, oh my god, it's Weird Al. Because I had actually sort of, not really bet, but quasi-bet someone at work that because Weird Al earlier in this year had like 500,000 signatures for him to play the Super Bowl halftime show.
Yeah.
Plus he's the number one selling music album in America this year, that Katy might have enough sort of postmodern humor to have him come out for a song. But it ended up being some rapper I've never heard of.
Missy Misdemeanor Elliott, and it actually was the best part of the halftime show. But here's my thing about the halftime show. Enough with Twitter America. And the reason I say this is, Daniel, you made mention of her riding a firework. Someone I was sitting there at the party with said, oh, it's the More You Know star. And I was like, you should tweet that. And he was like, yeah, but it would take too long for me to get to Twitter. And he was right, because I opened my Twitter, and that exchange was like 15, 20 seconds, and there were already like 15 to 20 tweets about it. So we're to the point that everyone is trying to be so impressive by tweeting something funny on Twitter, that common thing that everyone said in their room before there were in the room before there was Twitter is now what everyone rushes to Twitter to say. It's a rush. It's a race to see who can say the most common obvious thing about whatever's going on.
It's like an echo chamber of banshees.
Right. I mean, don't you think that I said when she came out in the fire dress and then was standing next to Lenny Kravitz. Oh, look, she's trying to be Katniss Everdeen. It was obvious, and you know they had that discussion before they went out there. They said, we're going to have you have a grand entrance. It's going to be like the Hunger Games. But I didn't tweet it because a bunch of other people tweeted it. It's not that epic of a thought. You don't need to get it out there. You're not winning anything. There's no winning Twitter.
It's true. You have to be really fucking clever.
Yeah. Bill Burr.
Just not that clever. You know who was really clever? At Iowa Hawk blog?
Yes. Really clever. David Berg, yes.
Yeah. Anyway. Fuck Katy Perry.
It's because they have a unique perspective and they focus on that and they don't try to go outside of it. Everybody tries to comment on everything and they don't have a unique perspective. Find your unique perspective and comment on that. I've been trying to do this points me hashtag to get on At Midnight, and I have focused on my unique perspective about things, not trying to, you know, point out everything about everything. I just try and find things that are interesting to me. Like, the one I did pregame was the Mexican avocado ones that I haven't seen anybody talk about, where I said, next year the worst two college football teams are going to be playing in the Avocado Bowl in Guadalajara.
It's true. Bring some chips.
All right, third Reddit. What harsh truth has life taught you? This is such a Reddit question.
Wow. The Katy Perrys of the world will always get to do the Super Bowl halftime show. Do you remember a few years ago when Madonna was doing it and she was fucking awful because she's Madonna? And I was so fed up with it that I actually in rage started a Facebook page, which I never did anything with, but the Facebook page was called Yo-Yo Ma for Super Bowl Halftime Show.
Yes, I remember that.
And my proposal is literally just Yo-Yo Ma on a folding chair with his cello playing some fucking concertos for 30 minutes. That's all I want.
So is that your harsh truth?
I mean, what harsh truth has life taught me? We all die. I mean, to me, truths are not necessarily harsh. They just are. It's how you react to them that is harsh or not. Like, I will never sprout wings and fly, which was a fantasy I always had as a child. Is that a harsh truth of reality? No, because I can go buy a fucking Southwest ticket for $79 and go anywhere I want.
All right, Elliot, do you actually want to participate in this?
No, it's just funny because
I'm participating.
No, but Daniel's right though. There's kind of a hidden premise in this question. You know, that to learn the truth about life as if the truths are bad or that they're disillusioning. And I don't know. I don't think that that's true. I mean, harsh truth. I mean, I guess if there are some truths that I guess have been hard to learn. I know for me, the idea that, yeah, you know, being a little chubby kind of turns some people away from you in terms of romantic prospects. And that's one of the things that's motivated me to lose weight and to continue losing weight. So, I've been trying to do that, and it started with kind of that recognition of a basic truth. You know, I don't know if it's harsh, but it is true.
Justin, do you want to participate?
No, not now, because I would feel ashamed. So we're going to move on to the next Reddit.
No, now we have to hear it. Now it's ratings gold.
What mildly infuriating thing can throw off your entire day? Well, how about when people hijack an entire question you picked and make it so you can't even answer it? How about that?
Oh, come on, Justin. You can answer the question.
No, we're on to the mildly infuriating thing.
All right.
We're on to Cincinnati.
Deb, I'm glad you picked up that reference.
Mildly infuriating thing. I think for me, it's when someone casually mentions like an accepted truth that is just so wildly false or misunderstood, but you're in a situation where you can't like respond in the way you want to. You have to hold it in and then it just festers in you all day and eventually you die of a stroke. So for instance, at work when like one of the vice presidents casually mentions to me about, you know, like deflating my lunch for the day or something really, really stupid. And you're like, uh-huh. Yeah, it's hysterical. You're a comedian. Eats me alive all day.
Elliot?
At work, I know that if you work in like any kind of customer service or hospitality position, and Faiza can probably answer this. She probably goes through this too. When you answer a person's question, a customer's question, and then after they leave, the next person in line comes up, you know that they've heard you answer this person's question. You know that they heard the person ask the question because they're standing right behind it, but they still come up to you and ask you the same damn question you just answered for the person that was standing right in front of them.
But they're special. Maybe you'll give them a different answer.
I'm sure they think so.
Right. Hi, I'm a snowflake. Can I have a different answer?
They always do that. I think I know what you're talking about at restaurants. So whenever I hear like the person in front of me, they say there's a 2-hour wait. I'm like, oh, there's a 2-hour wait. But other people will ask right after hearing that.
Yeah.
There's a 2-hour wait for that guy because he has an ugly blue shirt on. But you, sir, I like your nose. You have a 1-hour wait.
Well, right, like, this way, Mr. Kimmel.
Well, it's like Adam Carolla. Yeah. It's things like, you know, it's like, where's the bathroom? Okay, it's down the hall on your left. Then the next person, where's the bathroom? Like, I just freaking told the person standing in front of you, it's down the hall on the left. I mean, why are you asking when I know that you heard my answer?
They may also not be listening because they're in their own little world too. Not that that's an excuse, but I'm just saying that could be another reason.
It's you know where the bathroom is? It's where you swivel your neck from left to right and locate the bathroom sign. That's where the bathroom is.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I could never work at Disney.
What about you, Justin?
Well, I mean, we all know my frustrations with driving, but I am actually going to expand it outwards to it's walking too. Like I just
anytime Justin is mobile, the world is fucking him over.
It moves. It's ambulatory. Therefore, Justin is infuriated.
Yeah, it's not that the movement it makes me. It's the movement patterns where people they're just unaware you're even there.
It's true.
Unaware. And, you know, someone will cut me off, and I'll drive next to them, and I'll be just looking at them like, what the hell? And, like, letting them know. And they don't even look. They're so unaware. They're so unaware. And it's the same thing with walking. Somebody will walk into me, and I'll just be like, you just walked into me. And they won't even look at me. So it's not even the fact that they're doing this. It's the fact that they're not even cognizant of the fact that they're doing it. And even if you try to get their attention, they're not. I've honked at people, and they don't even register that someone's honking at them. I just don't understand how someone can be that unaware.
They're listening to Bill Burr CDs in their car. He's just screaming at them.
All right. Last Reddit. How can I become motivated to go to the gym after working long hours?
Good question.
Yeah. I think when I lack that kind of motivation, whether it's to work out or to work on something, I have to really concretize what the end result is and what my goal is. So I have to really think like I can either do nothing. And the end result will be that I have done nothing for X number of minutes. And at the end of my life, this is how much I have to concretize it sometimes. At the end of my life, I will have wasted X number of minutes. Or I can do this workout or this project and I will have accomplished something in reality. And at the end of my life, I will have not wasted that X number of minutes. And that's usually pretty fucking motivating.
That's a good answer. So I have two answers to this, which build on what Daniel was saying. The first is go before work.
Touche, salesman.
But no, the real answer, my second answer is after you've done what Daniel's saying and you know what you want to do and you know why you want to do it, just do it. It's not easy at first because you're changing your routine. You're changing your life. That's not easy. You've gotten used to a certain lifestyle. But if you've objectively identified something is better for you, Just make the change. And you know what? You'll get used to that too. And it will become the norm, and then it will be easy for you to do. But it's gonna be tough at first, and there really is no other answer except just do it. That's why Nike made that their slogan. Because you literally, you have to make that decision. You just have to put in the effort. That's it.
Hear, hear. Elliot?
That's a good question, because I have not been motivated to go to the gym, really. I mean, all my weight loss stuff has just really been me modulating what I'm eating, and that's worked pretty well for me, but I know that eventually I'm going to have to go to the gym. I guess for me, it would just have to have a conscious, it has to be like a conscious decision that I'm going to go do this because this is the outcome I want. This is the kind of body I want, the health that I want, and the kind of things that I want to be able to do. And this is the these are the steps that I need to take to get there, and I just need to do them. But I don't know. I'll be honest with you and admit that it's very hard to do. I mean, because when you work at a place like Disney, that's a very physical job in a very deceptive way. You're doing a lot of walking because you're usually parking somewhere, walking through the entire park to get to your location, and then you're on your feet most of the time, walking all the way back, and then the nature of your job is very often walking everywhere. So I myself am not always motivated, but it's because I physically do a lot of stuff during the day. So maybe I need to ask this question too.
That's interesting. Well, one sort of final tactic I recalled when I was younger, a tactic that was immensely helpful for me when, like, rehearsing music, for instance. I never wanted to practice music. I always thought I was such a good sight reader and natural musician that I never had to practice, but that was not true. So I traded with myself. For every minute of practicing the music, I got to play 2 minutes of Nintendo 64.
Yeah, that's a good point. I do that sometimes too, where I say, you know, if I meet this goal, then I'll see this movie or I'll buy this, or I do the converse as well, where I say, oh, I really want to watch that next episode of Black Mirror, but I won't do that until I've written X many people about the web series or something like that.
Yeah. So if you need some sort of motivation like that, then do it. Like, bribe yourself, literally.
Most of my rewards are food. That's my problem.
Well, and right, and that's ultimately
if
what
you
I'm
work
saying.
Out, you have that nice chocolate cake from Buca di Beppo. I mean, that's not going to work.
And that's what I'm ultimately saying about something like the gym, is it is a whole lifestyle change, and the only thing you can do is just say, I'm going to change this lifestyle, and accept that you're going to have to change the lifestyle, because you are who you are because of your choices, and the only way to change who you are is to make different choices. And you have to accept that basic truth, or the motivation is never going to be there.
Was that your harsh truth?
No.
Oh.
All right, let's put a cap on this. What did we learn this week? Daniel?
I learned that I seriously missed out on toys as a child because I never got the ring of power that made people disappear. I always had, like, the cardboard Power Ranger buckles that didn't actually transform me into any robotic dinosaur.
I had one too.
I'm a little sad. I would really enjoy the Ring of Power.
Elliot?
I learned that there are lots of other people on the Patriots team besides Tom Brady and my future husband, Rob Gronkowski.
Gronk, Mary.
Can we stop that Gronkowski joke? It's not funny. He's actually very well spoken. Like,
it's not that he's not well-spoken. It's that he's a friggin' monster. I always think of it as a Frankenstein thing, not as an intelligence thing. He's just enormous.
Yeah. One of my friends...
Go ahead. Oh, he looks like he could break people in half.
Yeah. One of my friends at work was saying, I was telling him how much I'm in love with Gronk, and they were like, but he's such an arrogant bastard. And I'm like, well, I don't know if that's true because I don't really know, but if it's true, that just kind of makes him a little more attractive to me.
Yeah, nothing about Gronkowski screams arrogance. I mean,
not at all. That is the stupidest thing I've ever heard.
Yeah. after all his injuries and everything? No, 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 no.
No, he's super funny. Like, and he comes off very well in the press conferences.
Yeah.
No, the Gronk, like Gronk spike, Gronk eat to me is because he's enormous in the same way we talk about Will Fork.
Yeah, but
Will Fork smash.
Yeah, I guess. I just think people will do it to slight his intelligence, but maybe I'm just sensitive to that.
He's gorgeous too, though.
All right.
Smart, so you're telling me he's smart on top of his sexiness?
Well, I mean, he's football smart is what I want to be clear about. I don't think he's a philosophical genius.
He's not discovering the Higgs boson, okay?
Right. I mean, you're good at what you're good at, and he's good at it, and that's all. Anyway.
Yeah. What did you learn?
What I learned is that we can actually start giving the official responses to things, and I think we need to.
Yes.
We just start saying, you know, the Ring of Power is fantasy. People have genders. I think we found our calling.
Yeah. Who better to give the official response than the Midside? I mean,
yeah.
Let's be serious here.
Midside Official Response Board, or MORB.
Can we make it morbid somehow?
Morbid.
This is becoming wicked from the Maze Runner.
So, yes, we are the official response team, and you are the people who power us. Yes, you, listeners, the people whose ear I am inside literally right now.
It's weird.
You empower us to be the official response team with the number of shares you give us, with the number of listens, with the comments. The comments are tremendous. I love the comments. So if you think that there should be more of us and less of everyone else, then you should share us with a friend or two personally and say, here, these guys talk about things and you would like it. You should probably be more articulate than that, but you get my point.
Not really. So, we're not much more articulate than that.
So. just barely. Midside eat. So the point is, thank you much for listening. And if you're enjoying it, help us out.
I'm Justin M. Lesneski, and I hope you learned something this week. This concludes your journey into the Midside. Good luck out there, and remember, Tom Brady is the greatest quarterback of all time.
Have a day.